For today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Chili. It's a great dish for a day like today. It's a chilly day. Light rain, dark skies. And, of course, chili is an easy dish to make. One pot, right? Well, at my house, we've done a lot of tinkering with chili recipes. My husband's is very good. Mine could use some work. Perfecting recipes is the mission of the folks who put together Cook's Illustrated magazine. Cook's Illustrated is known as America's Test Kitchen. In addition to the magazine, the editors of Cook's Illustrated have written lots of cookbooks. By my count, 32. Their latest is a companion book to their public television series, Inside America's Test Kitchen, New Recipes and Product Ratings from Public Television's Favorite Cooking Show. Our companion station, WILL-TV, airs America's Test Kitchen on Saturday afternoons at 12:30. One of the editors of Cook's Illustrated magazine is our guest in this portion of the program. His name is Matthew Card. He's an associate editor in the Cook's Kitchen and currently develops recipes and writes for the cookbooks in the Best Recipe series and for the magazine. Before going to Cook's Illustrated, he cooked at four restaurants, including Dean and DeLuca in Washington, D.C., and Empire Restaurant in New Rivers, both in Providence, Rhode Island. Listeners, if you have questions about cooking, about improving a recipe, give us a call. Talk to Matthew Card. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Matthew, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Always a treat.
You have a B.A. in English, a minor in history, and an M.A. in English literature. How was it that cooking became your profession?
Wow, that's a good question. I've done a little bit of everything, I think. I've always loved food. I remember being very young, and my mom was an avid cook, and she had a subscription to Gourmet since, I'm sure, well before I was born. But I remember being 6 or 7 and picking up Gourmet and folding to the centerfold, which was always like a big roast or a beef Wellington. And I remember asking my mom to make that for dinner. The pretty pictures. Those were my picture books.
And when did you begin cooking?
Probably my early teenage years, sort of experimenting with food and cooking. And my mom was always a very adventurous cook, and she really encouraged my sister and I to cook on our own and explore things. We'd eat out a lot. I grew up in D.C., so we'd go to Chinatown a lot for lunch and dinner. And really just adventuresome eating opened my eyes to cooking.
Yeah. So you weren't a picky eater as a kid, I bet.
No. I hated carrots. That was about the one thing I hated.
Yeah.
Carrots and pot roast.
Oh, that's interesting. I couldn't handle lima beans. Everything else I was fine with. But
we all have something.
Yeah. Well, today, what are your favorite foods? What are you in love with at the moment?
Wow. Being in New England right now where it's frigid, cooking a lot of braised dishes, anything that's hearty and cooks for hours and hours and hours, cassoulet, chucrut, heavy foods.
Yeah.
Looking forward to spring.
Yeah. Well, those foods warm up the kitchen and they smell so wonderful.
They do. I actually think the aroma is the biggest part of it, having this house that smells so good when it's so rough outside.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's kind of mild here today. It's 42 degrees, but it's a little damp, and it's quite dreary here. So those foods, I think we're still going to be cooking those for a little while yet, stews and chilies and the like.
Yep.
Yep.
In my house, we certainly will.
Yeah. Well, give us some background, if you would, on the history of Cooks Illustrated.
Well, Cooks Illustrated has been, the magazine has been published for about 10 years, and it's bimonthly, and the book department has been publishing books for about 6 or 7 years. The Best Recipe Cookbook was one of the first. The television show, which is on your local PBS mm-hmm. station, has been on for 3 seasons. We're just beginning our 4th season. So the magazine keeps growing. The books keep growing. We publish more and more. Have a brand new baking book hitting the shelves as we speak. And the TV show keeps growing in popularity.
Yeah. Well, how many people then does it take to do all the work you're doing?
Wow, we keep growing daily. I think I've lost count. I think there may be roughly 40 people on staff.
Uh-huh.
About 15 or so of those people are test cooks and editors, responsible daily for testing and development of recipes and tasting different food products and testing equipment. A busy kitchen.
Yeah. And tell us, if you would, a little bit about Christopher Kimball. The man behind it all.
The man in the bow tie.
Yeah.
Chris started a previous cooking magazine many years before Cooks Illustrated started. And so he's been doing this for quite a while. Cooks Illustrated is actually a reincarnation of his first magazine. But he is in the kitchen daily and is just as avid a cook as the rest of us are.
So what's life like in that kitchen?
Very, very busy. At any one time, there may be 10, 12 people cooking. The rest of the people are at their desk writing up their recipes. There could be, I'm trying to think, last week, at one point there was 10 different casseroles up to be tasted at the same time. It's a lot of food. And I think we take a lot of Tums, too.
Yeah, now, and you all look trim and slim, though.
Well, I think most of us are take yoga or avid runners. Yeah. I'm a bicycle racer, so yeah. We all try and stay active. You have to. I think
wow.
It'd be all too easy to balloon here.
Yeah, boy.
Everyone says, I tell people about my work, and like, wow, that just sounds like the best job ever. And it is, of course, except for the stomach ache.
Wow. And the, you know, and the risk of putting on the weight. I mean, because you're testing, you know, not only are you testing, you know, a little bit of a salad dressing, or you're doing taste comparison on different kinds of products, which you'd only take a little taste of. But also, you know, there's cheesecakes and cookies and
a lot of cheesecakes and a
chocolate
lot of cookies.
Mousse and you name it.
I think most people, when they first start, put on a freshman 15, and then they wake up one day, oh my God, what happened? And they start taking the local yoga class or start running during lunch.
Yeah. Now, in your off time, do you enjoy cooking?
I do. Yeah. I love going home from work and cooking for my wife, and it's just relaxing, and it's such a part of my life. You know, I thoroughly enjoy it. Even when I was cooking in restaurants where I'd be working 70 or 80 hours a week, I would go home and cook.
Yeah.
So fulfilling.
Yeah. How did you turn that corner from being someone who I would have imagined going into maybe teaching to cooking?
It was sort of a long and winding path.
Uh-huh.
I always loved food, and even when I was involved in academics, I cooked on the side and just always felt the pull of the kitchen. And when I was cooking in restaurants after graduate school, I sort of thought about food writing and actually started here at the magazine as an intern. Got my foot in the door, and I guess the rest is history. And this is a great combination of both my backgrounds, the writing and the cooking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine, listeners, and if you're just joining us, one of the editors of Cook's Illustrated is our guest in this portion of the program. His name is Matthew Card. He's an associate editor in the Cook's Illustrated Kitchen. He currently develops recipes and writes for the cookbooks in the Best Recipe series and for the magazine, Cook's Illustrated. You can join us, listeners, with questions, comments, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The television show, America's Test Kitchen, airs on our companion station, WILL-TV, by the way, on Saturday afternoons at 12:30. In my introduction, Matthew, I mentioned chili, and this is in the book. It's in Chapter 3, One Pot Wonders, Two Different Recipes, and you set out, as you often do in these books, with kind of a description of what you were looking for and then what you learned along the way. How do you go about deciding what you want?
Well, it's a very complicated process. The first step is we come up with the idea for a recipe, and from there, a particular editor who's assigned the piece will research all the recipes they can for, in this case, chili. And what they would do is sit down with those recipes and sort of come up with five or six that best represent different styles and different recipes,
mm-hmm.
and they'll cook those recipes. And then the test kitchen staff and the production staff and the marketing staff will all taste these five recipes. And it involves filling out tasting sheets, which evaluates each recipe for flavor, everything you can think of. And then the editor will take all that information and sort of synthesize it and develop a working recipe based off those five recipes, and then the test can go on for weeks and weeks from there.
Wow.
Yeah, it can take a couple months to develop one particular recipe.
Yeah. With your experience now at Cook's Illustrated, what have you learned about tasting?
Wow. Tasting is amazingly complicated. I think everyone has a slightly different palate. It's amazing what you can taste in things. And each time I go to a tasting, I'm always impressed by the different things people pick up on and what I myself pick up on. And it really is the fundamental part of tasting here at the Test Kitchen.
Yeah. For those of us who don't do this for a living, but of course we all eat every day, what might you advise us? How might you advise us to better enjoy our food, to taste it more carefully? I think sometimes we just shovel it in and, you know, we're not really enjoying it.
Yeah.
And not really discovering what's in there.
The only thing I can really recommend is people really take their time and enjoy what they eat. I think in this day and age, I think you're right. People are feeling so rushed and people tend to eat too quickly. I think my wife and I were just having this discussion that half the time we go out to dinner with friends of ours and you know, we're barely started by the time everyone else is done.
And yeah.
I really try and take my time and analyze what I'm eating and really enjoy everything about it.
Yeah. I think that's so important. I think in some restaurants, too, they're too eager to rush you along. Maybe they think that's what we want, but, you know, as soon as you get the salad, it's something else is going. So it's, you know, they have it down to a, you know, they've got their pace, and it might not be my pace. And
oh,
that's
absolutely
tough.
Their pace is designed to make them money.
Right. Turn over those tables.
I think that's one of the big problems with eating out these days is too often, you're right, you do get rushed. And you know what? You pay for the food. You pay for the table. You should never feel rushed eating out.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I just simply ask them if they could slow down a bit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'll tell wait staff, like, you know what? I'm not done with my salad. I shouldn't be getting my entree yet.
Right. Right.
Works sometimes. Sometimes I think they just go and put your meal underneath the heat lamp out back.
Oh, that's not so good either. Well, let's go back to chili. What you wanted at Cook's Illustrated in the kitchen, a basic all-American chili made with supermarket staples, ground meat, tomatoes, chili powder, and canned beans. That was easy to make and delicious.
Absolutely.
So, and this is something I think everybody can identify with, you know? There's, you know, there comes a time when you got to get dinner on the table and you want it to be good. And here we've got a great couple of recipes here.
Oh, absolutely. As you said earlier, it's the One Pot Wonders chapter. And this is really the best straight-up all-American chili I've had. It's very simple combination of flavors, onions, bell pepper, garlic, ground beef. I know a lot of people might cringe at the thought of ground beef and chili, but in this case, for an all-American chili, it's certainly the way to go. We've also developed chili con carne recipes, more sort of traditional Texan chilies, but those involve some pretty esoteric chilies, anchos, pasillas, which not everyone can get, and the kids might not be so happy with.
Right.
But when we were developing this chili recipe, we found that for the best flavor, the spices, the chili powder, cumin, coriander, really needed to be toasted before any other ingredients were added. This really helps the flavors of the spices bloom, which means really intensify. And we also found that the juices from the tomato in the chili were enough. Every time we added other ingredients, you see a lot of chili recipes with coffee, which I like personally, but coffee or beer or water or broth, we found it didn't really need it. Those just managed to dilute the flavor.
Yeah. Now, you like dark red kidney beans. That's the recommendation in this beef chili with kidney beans. Why the dark kidney beans?
Oh, I think that was probably just a personal preference of the editor.
Oh, okay. That can happen, huh?
It certainly can. I mean, I think all the recipes are inflected with a bit of personality as much.
Yeah.
It is a joint effort, but we all have our preferences.
Yeah. Are there times when everybody is in agreement?
That's the ideal. That's what we aim for, is consensus in the kitchen, but that's not always the case. I mean, we have 20 different palates tasting each recipe, and not everyone likes the same thing. So we try and get a quorum and go from there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes everyone's thrilled with the recipes, and those are happy moments.
Yeah. In the course of doing the evaluation for beef chili, you evaluated tomato purees. And this was interesting to me. I mean, here, you know, we've got a number of things, and quite a few recommended. I think all of these are recommended. But you can see, you know, you can see as we were talking earlier about tasting, a lot of very, you know, very interesting things that people are picking up on here on tomato purees. Strong with a fresh, mild flavor, or some another brand, somebody thought it was too sweet. Somebody on another brand said good flavor, maybe, but maybe just a little bitter.
I remember this tasting, and it was
wasn't
too enjoyable.
Really?
Tastings are amazing. I think it's something that in the real world you really don't have the chance to do, to sit down or necessarily want to do in the case of tomato puree.
No.
I mean, for each tasting, we'll pick a particular ingredient. In this case, it was tomato puree, and we'll purchase all the available brands and sit down and taste those. They'll be evaluated with very tight criteria, with tasting descriptors, salty, sweet, sour, watery, bland, things like that. And everyone's responses are formulated into a table, and it's very scientific, to cut to the chase there. And it's amazing, the results. I mean, you would think tomato puree would all be the same, but they were all over the place.
Yeah. Well, we've been doing some along the way in the kitchen at home. We've been tasting some different tomato products, and There are differences. It's kind of surprising, and my husband swears that there's a difference between the San Marzano tomatoes and just the ordinary tomato, canned tomato.
Ah, he likes the Italian tomatoes,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
A lot of people swear by those. I personally quite like them. We haven't done much testing on them here. We tend to test products that are very widely available, sort of supermarket staples.
Yeah.
San Marzano's are sort of a specialty store still.
Yeah. Although here in this market, I think that we've got a pretty fierce supermarket battle going. And there seems to be a contest to who can stock the most ethnic food items, which is very nice.
And, yeah, the consumer wins then.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's very nice. So we're seeing a lot more variety of products in the supermarket. Are you ever surprised when the identities of the products are revealed? And you go, oh, I never thought that would be any good.
Absolutely. I can't tell you how many times I'm surprised at what I like, what I hate, what I had to spit out. It's amazing. Olive oil was one tasting I remember doing where I absolutely loathed the olive oil I had used for the past 5 years at home.
Really?
When I'd actually tasted that olive oil compared to 10 other olive oils, it was horrible, but somehow I'd used it all along and never known.
And what's your current favorite olive oil, then?
At the magazine for supermarket olive oils, we love a brand called Da Vinci.
Uh-huh.
It's well-rounded, full-flavored, and pretty inexpensive compared to most.
Yeah. I was surprised in the tasting evaluation that in the area of red wine vinegars, Pompeii scored so highly.
Just a supermarket staple.
Yeah.
Really reasonably priced, and it really did well.
Yeah, and the one that I've been using is not recommended.
Ooh.
So I'll have to, next time we need red wine vinegar, I'll have to try out the Pompeii.
Ah, definitely.
Yeah. Have you considered publishing all these product reviews within the covers of one book?
We have. I'm not sure the status of that project.
Yeah.
Currently, they run throughout all of our cookbooks.
Right.
There's got to be 15 or 20 within Inside America's Test Kitchen alone.
Yeah.
Both tastings, and then there's equipment testings as well.
Yeah. That would be a handy tool to have, although I don't know what the shelf life would be of such a publication.
It certainly would be handy. I would think it would have to undergo revisions almost yearly.
Right, right. Potholders. Let's talk about some equipment. This was fun to read. You see these things on television on another channel, as they say. Silicone is popping up in kitchens, TV kitchens, on another channel on cable. And this is something I had wondered about, actually. How comfortable, how safe are they? And turns out you folks didn't like them too much because they can be awful slippery.
Oh, they really are. As soon as they get any grease on them, hands slide out of your hand, and they get really dangerous. They look so good, though.
Maybe.
I remember, I hate potholders. All I use is kitchen towels in my house, and I remember seeing the silicone potholders thinking, you know what, I could have one of these in my kitchen. And then we tested them, and they were just horrible.
And no doubt you like the towel because it will conform to the pan and to your hand.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's infinitely washable. I think I must go through a dozen dish towels a week at my house. But I guess you get used to it working in restaurant kitchens where that's all you have. You have a couple side towels a day, and you use those for hot pans, pulling stuff out of the oven, everything.
Yeah. I like the mitt, though, the old-fashioned Terry mitt.
Well, they rated second here in our team.
They rated testing pretty well, yeah.
I have to admit, the leather, the Lamson Sharp leather potholder that came in first, it's really a treat to work with.
Yeah, and I was surprised to learn that's washable.
Yeah, it's treated so that it won't harden.
Yeah, Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, if you have questions about cooking, about improving your recipe, give us a call. Talk to Matthew Card. He's our guest this afternoon. He is an associate editor in the Cook's Illustrated Kitchen and currently develops recipes and writes for the cookbooks in the Best Recipe series and for the magazine Cook's Illustrated. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join us, here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, besides those towels, what are your favorite tools in the kitchen?
Tongs.
Tongs, okay.
I would be hard-pressed to live without a pair of tongs. I guess another professional kitchen tool that I just can't do without. I use them for, I mean, all the usuals, of course, turning meat and all that, but you can use them as a spoon. They're great when, or if you close them, you can stir stuff with them for cooking pasta.
Uh-huh.
It's very easy to stir the pasta and separate the different pieces of pasta with tongs. For pulling small pans out of the oven, really endless. So I hate doing dishes, so I use one tool for everything when I'm cooking.
Very good. What else do you have to have in the kitchen?
A good cutting board.
Oh.
Very fond of a big wood one, especially because the fact that wood doesn't harbor cross-contamination the way plastic can, which is always surprising. I used to always think that, oh, you can't have a wooden cutting board. It must hold on to chicken goo and that sort of thing. But it actually proves it's healthier than a plastic board as far as getting rid of contaminants.
How do you keep that wooden board clean?
Scrub it. Scrub it really well. Just soap and water and dry it. I always dry my cutting boards right after washing them so that they don't warp.
Yeah.
And couldn't live without a good chef's knife.
Oh, definitely.
A chef's knife and a paring knife, I think those are pretty much the only two knives I use.
Yeah. And a skillet? You got to have a skillet?
Skillets, yes. As far as pans go, I cook almost all my dinners in a big 12-inch skillet, something we've done endless testing on as far as equipment goes.
If we're in the market for a skillet, what would you suggest we consider? What features would you look for?
Well, you want a nice weight to it. You want some good heft. I strongly recommend an oven-safe handle. I think a lot of inexpensive skillets come with plastic handles that you can't put in the oven. But then it's very hard to oven roast things, a technique we use a lot with meats, sort of cooking the roast, searing the roast stovetop, and then sliding the whole pan in the oven. After testing a dozen odd skillets, our favorite is from a company called All-Clad.
Mm-hmm.
And really just flawless performance. That's about $125 for a 12-inch skillet, which is pretty pricey, I think, but it's a very good long-term investment. Our best budget buy is a skillet from Calphalon, which is at $65, almost half the price. It works great.
Yeah. Well, that All-Clad should last you forever.
They really do. I've seen them burnt, blackened, anything possible you could do to a pan. I've seen it happen to an All-Clad, and I've seen it that pan the next day, shiny as can be, in a restaurant kitchen.
Yeah.
It's amazing what they can go through.
Yeah. At the same time, I don't think I would want a all my pans, pots and pans, to be the same thing. And this is something I kind of learned some time back when I think it was when I was getting out of school. My mother, for a gift, gave me a set of cookware. And over time, I added to that, and I added different kinds of different brands. And really, you know, like for some things, I really like the Le Creuset, you know, the stock pot for stewing.
Absolutely.
Because it has such a great heavy lid and it goes in the oven beautifully.
Yeah, we've tested Dutch ovens, and the All-Clad and Crusade tied there. I think I tend to favor the Crusade just because it's so heavy and holds the heat so well. And they're really pretty.
Yeah. On the other hand, I don't think I'd want to be hefting that brand if I was going to be doing, let's say, you know, mashed potatoes or something. I wouldn't want to be lifting that thing in the kitchen full of water.
No. That, you need some good brawn to do that.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to talking about ingredients. Cornbread is a good thing to go with chili, and in this book, you don't do cornbread per se, but you do corn muffins, and it was interesting reading the comments of the crew about the different corn meals out there.
Oh, there's a huge difference there between sort of the commercial and the stone ground or smaller producer, and what we found is really that for the best flavor and texture, it's best to buy stone ground when you can. I think there's a couple different brands we like quite a bit. Arrowhead Mills and Hodgson Mill are both national brands. They have such a richer, fuller flavor. I mean, they really taste of the corn. Those still are processed with the germ still in. Companies like Quaker remove the germ because it can go rancid quickly. So it's a sacrifice there. It's a longer shelf life, longer storage for the Quaker, but the flavor isn't quite there.
Yeah. Well, for those other whole grain corn meals, is it wise to keep them in the fridge then?
Definitely.
Yeah.
It can be stored in the refrigerator or the freezer.
Yeah.
Try and purchase fairly small bags and go through them quickly.
Yeah. In terms of the Hodgson Mills, this is the brand that we use at home, and I really love the flavor of it, but it can be a little gritty. So if you wanted to make a corn, like a sweetened cornbread cake, you know, with blueberries or something, it might not be the right thing.
No.
So Arrowhead Mills would be not so gritty?
Yes, it's a little finer than the Hodgson Mill.
Yeah. Now, Hodgson Mills, could I put that in the food processor?
You know, that's a good question. I've never tried that.
Yeah.
I bet it would work, though I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I hate to stand by that.
Okay, well, I'll play around with that. Because it's, you know, it is nice just to have one type of the of an ingredient like that in the house. You don't.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I actually mix corn meals a lot. I try and purchase a couple different types of cornmeal, very fine, some coarse. And when I make cornbread, I like the different textures intermingling there. Or with polenta. I really love the different combinations in that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of flours, we talked about cornmeal now. Bread flour, all-purpose flour, cake flour, pastry flour.
Enough to make your head spin.
Yeah, it sure is. And I'm not quite sure. The all-purpose flour, of course, is the all-American standby here. That's really, probably if you're going to have one, have that in the house. But what makes bread flour different from all-purpose flour?
Well, flours are different according to the protein content. And what the protein content affects is gluten development. The more protein you have in a flour, the more gluten development will occur. So bread flours have a very high percentage of protein compared to, say, pastry flour. Bread flour is often 13% to 14%, and pastry flour can be 7% to 9%. All-purpose flour hits someplace down the middle. That can be anywhere from 9% to 11%, maybe up to 12%, but generally closer to 9%. So it can do well at just about anything. The only time we really specify bread flour is for very hearty breads that really need the gluten and protein, like the artisanal sort of breads, very chewy, that sort of thing.
Yeah, or a whole grain bread, maybe?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. If you're making a whole wheat bread, whole wheat flour actually has very little gluten protein. So it doesn't develop gluten the way white flour does. So bread flour is a good addition there.
Yeah. What's the shelf life for flour?
That's a good question. We always recommend that you keep your flour tightly sealed, mm-hmm. much to keep bugs out of your flour as to keep it from oxidizing. But I would try and use it within 6 months.
Oh, okay.
4 to 6 months.
Yeah. And you've also tested baking powders, and this was good to know. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, pretty much. All the national brands work pretty much as well.
Freshness is the key, though, and so there's another shelf life question. What's the shelf life, you suppose, for baking powder?
Well, we recommend no more than a year. It's so inexpensive.
Right.
If you're not sure of the date, it's probably best to buy a new bottle.
Yeah.
You can test it, though, by putting a bit in water, and if it foams up a lot,
uh-huh.
then you know it's still active.
Yeah. Are there food science people on the staff of Cooks Illustrated?
We do. We have a science editor, John Olson, who we all hit up with our science questions whenever we're developing a recipe and something crosses our mind. We go to John, and as absurd as the question may be, he gives you a look, quizzical look, and says, And more often than not, about 20 minutes later, he'll either come up with a test to prove something that you're questioning, or sort of information to go from. I think he's out back right now trying to grill or test the temperature of different grills, and it's maybe 30 outside here. So it's great having an in-house science editor. We used to have to shoot our questions to outside scientists, and they didn't always get what we were doing. So sometimes they couldn't quite answer our questions. Maybe they were just so amateurly stated that they didn't get what we were trying to say.
Yeah. It's not rocket science. It's food science.
Yeah, but food science is pretty complicated.
Yeah, it is, and it's very interesting, isn't it?
We try and address the science questions and give sort of practical kitchen knowledge science.
Yeah. And I would think maybe some scientists wouldn't see it as very glamorous. Maybe that's...
No, but it's tastier than...
The perks are maybe a little bit better, aren't they?
Certainly.
Yeah. One of the issues that we have often at home is what kind of sides are we going to have? And what kind of advice do you have for folks who are tuning in this afternoon in terms of sparking up the vegetables, the starches that, you know, are on the plate so often, especially at this point in the year when there's really not much fresh.
This is a rough time of year to be cooking vegetables. My wife and I were at the market trying to find something Saturday, and slim pickings.
Yeah.
We always suggest, you know, good fresh seasonal vegetables, but of course this is February, so that's hard. We have a best recipe series book out called Perfect Vegetables, which is probably the best advice I can give, offers a couple hundred different quick vegetable suggestions. It goes through vegetable by vegetable, giving 4 or 5 recipes for each.
Hmm. And in this book, you've done quite a turn with mashed potatoes.
Oh, we have.
Wow.
There's all sorts of mashed potatoes in here, as well as different salad recipes.
Yeah. And the mashed potatoes, there's one that's pretty intriguing to me. It involves some whole grain mustard and cheddar cheese.
That's one of my favorites. To me, I could think of nothing better to go with a nice pork roast. These are all sort of jazzed up mashed potato recipes. Something a little different than the plain mashed potatoes most people have. These are one with blue cheese and pork caramelized onions, and there's smoked paprika and toasted garlic, scallions and horseradish. It's probably the easiest there. And the smoked cheddar and grainy mustard you brought up.
Yeah. How do you... Who comes up with the ideas about, you know, well, what can we pair with, you know, something that we think is pretty humble but is one of my favorites, mashed potatoes?
I think it's one of everybody's favorites. It's the editor, well, it's a joint effort, I think. Recipes are assigned to particular editors, and they'll come up with an outline as far as tasting, testing, development. and they'll come up with recipe ideas. And most of us have quite a bit of restaurant experience, at least 5 to 7 years across the board for test cooks. So we have pretty wide food knowledge, and editors will come and we'll brainstorm and just really try and create some pretty interesting ideas.
Yeah. One of the things that we've been doing at home recently, sweet potatoes, steaming them and mashing them, and wondering what else we can do besides, you know, a little bit of nutmeg and a little bit of cinnamon.
Sweet potatoes are really versatile. Trying to think. One of the flavors I love with sweet potatoes is chipotle chilies.
Oh, uh-huh.
Which is a smoked jalapeno and a little bit of chipotle with some brown sugar and butter. It's awesome. Another combination I really like is vanilla. A little, sometimes I'll simmer the mashed potatoes, I'm sorry, the sweet potatoes with a vanilla bean and scrape the seeds into the potatoes when I'm mashing them. It's really floral, beautifully perfumed flavor. I like to add a lot of black pepper with that. It really picks up the vanilla.
Yeah. Tell me, I've been thinking about, you know, one of the fruits that's in the store right now that is really wonderful are pears. And I'm wondering if you could put roasted pears and sweet potatoes together.
That sounds good.
Sounds good? Okay. I was wondering if it might be too much of a, you know, of a sweet thing, but...
It might be, but this time of year, sometimes sweet, starchy foods are good next to a pork roast or roast chicken.
Let's talk with a listener, caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to call and ask about the flour question. I'm from Canada, and when I go to Canada, we always enjoy 100% whole wheat bread from the bread machine. Now, what's the difference between the flour in Canada and the flour down here? When we use 100% whole wheat here in our bread machine, it's very sticky and, you know, moist. So we usually try and bring a 50-pound bag of flour back with us, but we don't have any right now. I'd like to know what the difference is, and if you could suggest somewhere that I could buy, like a mail-order company or something that I could buy that flour from.
Wow. You know, I was born in Canada, but never really lived there that much. I'm not sure. It might be a different variety of wheat being processed. That would be my guess, because there are numerous different varieties of wheat, and they tend to all have different qualities, hard wheat, summer wheat, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I've heard somebody said that one is hard and the other is soft. Now, I don't even understand the difference between the two. Do you know if American is hard or soft? Or
It can be either or. This is where things get a little confusing. What I might recommend you do is, if you have internet access, KingArthur.com. King Arthur's a flour company in Vermont, and they carry a very broad range of flours, and they could probably... They probably have something that would that could replace the Canadian whole wheat flour you're looking for.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Good luck. Coming back with a 50-pound bag of flour.
Wow.
Wow.
I bring maple syrup back, but a little smaller than a 50-pound bag.
Yeah, you can fit it in your carry-on. We've got to wrap up here pretty quickly. I just wanted to let you know that my husband and I have made the pad thai in the book, and it's great.
It's one of the best pad thais I've ever had.
Yeah, it's right on the money, and it's not hard.
It's really not. And it's one of the exciting things about making that at home is that it is so authentic, and it's really not difficult.
No, not difficult at all. One other question I have for you before we go. In terms of making beef stew, what would your advice be for choosing the cut of beef?
Well, you know, we've tested everything we can as far as beef goes, and we really like chuck roast. It's got the best flavor.
Okay.
And it's inexpensive.
Okay, very good. And how is it on, does it have a little fat in it? Is that also helpful?
That certainly helps.
Okay, very good.
As we all know, fat is flavor.
Okay. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. It's been a treat.
Matthew Card has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's an associate editor in the Cook's Illustrated Kitchen. He currently develops recipes and writes for the cookbooks in the Best Recipe series and for the magazine Cook's Illustrated. By the way, the latest Cook's Illustrated book is Inside America's Test Kitchen, New Recipes and Product Ratings from Public Television's Favorite Cooking Show. And that Favorite Cooking Show is on our companion station, WILL-TV, on Saturday afternoons at 12:30. America's Test Kitchen, Saturday afternoons at 12:30 on WILL-TV. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Indeed they are, Celeste, from the Board of Trade. Quite a day at the Chicago Board of Trade where beans plowed through $9 today. We'll get to those settlement prices in just a bit, but we'll start in the wheat pit for the afternoon. The March contract on this Monday, today a high of 394, a 395, a low at 375, and a settlement price at 391. They were up 19.5 cents in the wheat pit. May contract 404, the high, the low at 383. A settlement price there at 398, up 19 cents. July futures for the wheat, $4 even on the high, the low at 381, settled 394 and three quarters, up 18 and a quarter. And September futures, 401, the high, the low at 385 and a half, a settlement price 397, up 16 and three quarters. December wheat, 408, the high, the low at 393, a settlement at 404, up 16 and a half for the day. Corn futures managed a steady gain, but not nearly as strong as the wheat or the soybeans for the day. The March corn up 2.5 cents. At a high today of 289.5, a low at 285.5, and a settlement price, once again, 287.25, 2.5 cents higher for that March corn contract. May futures, 297, the high, the low at 292.25, settlement price, 294, up 3 cents, and the July's, 298.75, high and low at 294.75, the settlement there, 296.5. They finished 3 higher on the day. September corn 293 high, low at 288.5, a settlement price at 290.75, up 2.75, and the December corn contract 290 the high, the low at 285, a settlement price 288.25, up 3.5 cents. March futures 291.5 high, low at 287.5, a settlement price 290.5, up 3.25, and the July corn for 05 293 the high, the low at 290, settled 292, up 3 cents. December 05, this 2 years out, 260 the high, the low at 258.5. December 05 corn settled 259, they were up 2 cents as well. March oats 153.5 the high, the low at 150.75, settlement price 151.25, a penny and a half higher. And the May oat futures 157.5 high, low at 155, a settlement price 155.75, up 2 for the day. From the soy complex now, the futures there sharply higher across that floor. March contract in the bean pit 918.5 the high, the low at 905, settlement price $9.11, up 18.5 cents on the day. May futures in the bean pit 912.5 the high, the low at 896, a settlement at 907, settled 23.5 cents higher. And the July's 891 the high, low at 876, a settlement price 888, up 25.25. The September futures 778 the high, the low at 763. And the settlement price at 776, up 28 cents. Now the November futures. Here's where things really got interesting, as they were about twice as high for the day as the nearby months. And that's been unusual in this trade, where the old crop has been moving much more high, much quicker than the new crop. November beans, 708 the high, low at 682. Settlement price, 705, up 33.25 on the day. January beans, 705 the high, the low at 681, a settlement there above $7 at 704, 32 cents higher. And the March futures for the beans, this is next year's crop, 705 the high, the low at 682, a settlement price $7.04 there as well, up 30 cents on the day. March bean meal now, 277 even on the high, the low at 271.60, settlement price at 274.70, they were up 450 on the day. And the May meal, 277.50 on the high, the low at 271.50, a settlement price at 274.60, up 470. March bean oil contract, 33.80 the high, the low at 33.15, a settlement price 33.66, up 73, and May bean oil 33.63 the high, low at $32.85, a settlement price at $33.55. They were up 97. Be sure to stay with us through the 2 o'clock hour as Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Futures in Normal, Illinois, will talk to us about what happened at the Board of Trade, specifically about what happened in the wheat and the bean pits and those deferred contracts for the soybeans on the new crop as they make some gains, some big gains this afternoon. Also, we'll talk to him about the Mercantile Exchange. Here now with those numbers is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. It was a lower day today for feeder cattle. Live cattle and lean hogs finished higher, while February and March bellies finished lower. March feeder cattle, the high today, 84.60, the low 83.50, the settlement 83.90, that down 27.5. April, 84.30, the high 83, even the low 83.30, the settlement, that down 75. May, 85.27.5, the high, the low, 83.85, the low, the settlement, 84.35, that down 60. August, 88 even, the high, 86.75, the low, 87.30, the settlement, that down 60. February live cattle, 78.60, the high, 77.50, the low, 78.57.5, the settlement, that up 72.5. March, 75.10, the high, 74.30, the low, 75.10, the settlement, that up 30. April, 73.65, the high, 72.40, the low, 73.62.5, the settlement, that up 80. June, 70.40, the high, 69.75, the low, 70.37.5, the settlement, that up 35. April lean hog, 61.07.5, the high, 59.45, the low, 61.02.5, the settlement. That up 92.5. May lean hog, 61.30 the high, 60.25 the low. The settlement today, 61.27.5. That up 32.5. June lean hog, 65.30 the high, 64.30 the low, 65.17.5 the settlement. That up 30. July lean hog, 62.10 the high, 60.55 the low, 62.02.5 the settlement, that up 65. February pork bellies, 97.52.5 the high, the low 94.52.5, the settlement 96.20, that down 132.5. March pork bellies, 97.25 the high, 94.40 the low, and today's final price for March bellies, 96.20, that down 105. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently down 37 points at 10,582. The NASDAQ is down 38 points at 2,000. The S&P 500 is off 6 points at 1138.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2004 lecture series presents Cross Currents Between Film and Concert Music by Don Davis, composer of many film scores, including The Matrix, Wednesday, February 25th at 4 p.m. in the auditorium, room 2100 of the Music Building, 1114 West Nevada Street, Urbana, on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Daniel Zinke, age 6, Oakland, California, writes, Dear Dr. Science, do you know the name of God's dog?
I do, but federal regulations prohibit me from telling you. Now, if you were 36 instead of 6, I might be able to make some clever allusion to literature or play some cute word game that would help you discover God's dog's name on your own. There are also the theological considerations. It's my understanding that the Swiss Guard, you know those guys in funny costumes who make up the Vatican's